through the day. We have a lot of bills that are listed as public hearing. We're just going to pass these in for introductory purposes only, with the exception of 3338, which we do have some people here to speak about. So I'm just going to go running through these, and then we'll plan to revisit some of these later. Open the public hearing, House Bill 3157. Close the public hearing, House Bill 3157. Open the public hearing, House Bill 2765. Close the public hearing, House Bill 2765. Open the public hearing, House Bill 2090. Close the public hearing, House Bill 2090. Open the public hearing, House Bill 3588. Close the public hearing, House Bill 3588. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3002. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3002. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3330. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3330. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3200. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3200. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3510. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3510. Open the public hearing on House Bill 2375. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2375. Open the public hearing, House Bill 3412. Close the public hearing, House Bill 3412. Open the public hearing, House Bill 3338. And you're welcome to step forward and present the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Rasmussen.
You may have a career as leader in the House.
Right. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee.
For the record, my name is Walter Burns. I am the legislative representative and advocate for the Non-Commissioned Officers Association. And I have with me today Colonel Michael Caldwell from the Oregon National Guard. Briefly, what this bill does is to try... It eliminates the reference to the Gulf, Pershing Gulf operation, which is in the current law, and it tries to make it time and event neutral so that any future activity the President calls on for the troops to be called up, such as that we are having now, would be covered. Also, it tries to bring the current law in line, the Oregon tax law, in line with the federal tax treatment of the military people and those called to active duty. One thing is the exemption of tax for the money that they're paid while they're in a combat zone. And also the delay of reporting of taxes while in a combat zone. Now, one of the things the federal law has in it is called a Qualified Hazardous Duty Area, QHDA. These areas are also considered tax purposes, combat zones. And this is, at present, it's Bosnia-Herzegovina, the Persian Gulf area, Macedonia. Of course, these have all become combat areas, but you will find in your packet, right behind my written testimony, a request for changes to House Bill 3338. The purpose of these changes is to include this qualified hazardous duty area and also to add the time reporting time extension, which did not get into the original bill. And I would ask that the committee would approve adding that onto the bill and having it printed up as in Gross A.
Mr. Cruz, where is that language?
It's immediately after my written testimony. You should have the cover sheet, the page of my written testimony, and then it's a request to Representative Julie Giannella, a letter to her requesting it.
Okay.
Behind that is a document that was given to me from the National Guard Judge Advocate General Office that explains some of this stuff in the very generalized terms and what the federal government is doing. Behind the blue page is the federal law. There's a Title 26 sheet that goes into combat zones. Then there's Public Law 104-117. Then there's the IRS Code 7508 with the last couple of pages are a supplement or a addition to that, making revisions.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't get a chance to mark all the attachments with numbers.
No problem. I think we can follow that. Let me ask you a question, though. On the your suggested amendment is to add or assigned to qualified hazardous duty area. I think that's pretty clear. But would it not make a little more sense to have the matching phrase that's in the federal law, the combat zones, rather than the period of combatant activities language? And I'm not sure that there's a definition of period of combatant activities that I'm aware of.
Well, yeah, combat, if they're assigned to a combat zone.
Mr. Chairman, let me make a shot at that.
Sure.
Not every...
Identify yourself.
I'm sorry. For the record, Colonel Mike Caldwell with the Oregon National Guard. I'll give you an example. Recently, as we've seen in the Balkan states, there's been a lot of activity. In our case, we've had call-ups of units that have been deployed to Germany, and that isn't in the combat zone, but it certainly is in support of the activity. In our case, it would be like Utah, for example, the distance. So they are still pulled up from their home. They're still deployed in support of the activities going on, but yet they're not being shot at, per se, or have that kind of a risk. Nevertheless, it's still a great impact on them. It is reserve or National Guardsmen.
I understand that, but I'm looking at this attachment. It looks to me like the federal IRS exception is for people who are in combat zones, and is the federal exception on the taxes also include a period of combatant activities in their definition?
Sure. I wouldn't give a guess on that, but
yeah.
I'll get back to you with that.
Okay, it doesn't look like it. I'm just trying to make our statute conform with the same language in the federal one, you see.
Are you referring to the changes I've requested on line 8 and 10, where it says activity and then add?
No, I understand that. I'm questioning on line 8 and 10 the phrase, a period of combatant activities, which seems to lack a specific definition. Rather than a combat zone. And I believe we already have, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we already have don't we have a deferral of taxes or some other sort of exception for people who are called up to active duty?
Mr. Chairman, the committee is basically a $3,000 exemption for $3,000 on federal active duty outside the state of Oregon.
Okay. Okay, any other questions? Representative Williams?
Thank you. Colonel, That exemption you just talked about, does that apply to our National Guard units when they are called up, or is it only, I know sometimes these statutes don't always necessarily protect Guard members in the same way they protect people who are on current active status. Does that particular exemption protect the Guard members as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, yes, it does.
Okay.
It's the Guard and Reserve vote.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions? Is there anything else you want to add?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, again, the Oregon National Guard does support this move. As you undoubtedly noticed, even in the paper this morning, there's going to be more call-ups given the situation in the Balkan states presently. But given the size and the makeup of the active duty force, whether it be Army, Navy, Marine Corps, or Air Force, the situation is such in this nation that we cannot do these operations anywhere without calling the Guard and Reserve. It can't be done.
Right.
And so this is going to be more often than not less often. So I think taking that language out specifically for Desert Storm makes a logical sense given the makeup and size of the armed forces of this nation.
Yeah, unfortunately it does. Can you tell me if the... the area in Germany, for example, that you just referenced, would be considered a qualified hazardous duty area under the public law that the amendment suggests?
Mr. Chairman, I'll need to get back to you on that. I can't do that. I don't know that off the top of my head. The situation, and we just returned 15 people from Hungary and Bosnia. This unit was a parceled out unit. And so the problem becomes when, let's say, the headquarters of the unit may be stationed in Germany, but people went over to these other areas because of the assignments and the nature of the unit. So now we've got a situation where we'd almost have to, in some fashion, for tax purposes, punch a time clock where we say, well, how many days were you down in Hungary? How many days were you in Bosnia? And that's just not feasible. It's not logical. So I think we need to look at that and see how the federal government looks at that particular situation, and try to match up with that so we make it easier on the individuals when they come home and have to file a tax return.
Okay.
We will take a look at that, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr.
Chair?
The bill is drafted, as I understand it, is very broad. With compensation for active service outside this state during a period of some time, that could be assigned to a unit in Washington or Idaho. It's during combatant activity.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Satterley, I have talked to, I think he's a major now in the reserves, Bob Hagen, and I was hoping he would be here today to help with the testimony. That's fine. He has mentioned to me that in the past he has been in Washington, D.C. and been under these rules. So it's in support of, and this would also apply like to Germany or someplace like that, where you're in support of, and it's considered a part of it. So then, they're given the exemption. I don't pretend to know all the ins and outs of the IRS code, but I'm trying to bring this into the Oregon code to be as close to the federal as I can.
Representative Shelley, that's why I want us to investigate whether the combat zone language ought to be
replaced. Representative Shelley, we'll take both of those phrases back and see if we can't get the lawyers to come up with a worksheet that makes logical sense and tie in the two to the federal code and see, and then we'll get back to them.
Okay.
Okay.
That'll be great. Thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3338. and open the public hearing on episode 3428. Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Raleigh Wisbrock. I'm Chief of Staff of the Oregon Treasury, and I'll be joined by Chuck Smith, who heads our Debt Management Division, and Cynthia Burns from the Attorney General's Office. I'd like to address some modifications through House Bill 3428 on the School Bond Guarantee Act. Just in brief review before I turn it over to Mr. Smith and to Ms. Burns. Measure 54 last year was approved by the voters of the state of Oregon, and it allowed school districts K-12 to use basically the state's bond rating as they issued debt. It allowed us to guarantee their debt. We went into this program with our eyes wide open. It's a very good program, and nothing's changed in our attitude about the program, and we'd like to just kind of fine-tune a good vehicle. Again, in background, there is no exposure to the state's rating. We ran this program by the rating agencies. They're very, very comfortable with it. They think it's an excellent opportunity to bring benefits to local school districts, save them tens of millions of dollars without any expense or risk to the state, and that's from the bond rating agency. So it's really fine-tuning, an excellent instrument, and I will then turn it over to Chuck to show you how we're hoping to fine-tune that excellent instrument.
Okay, thank you. Raleigh, are you asking us to overturn the will of the people?
to improve the quality of the thinking of the will of the people.
Every time you get something that people have voted on, we get that. Perhaps not in this case.
Certainly not in this case.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chuck Smith, and I'm the manager of the Debt Management Division of the Oregon State Treasury. During the 1997 legislative session, the legislature passed the referral to the people, and as Raleigh just mentioned, it was Measure 54. Simply, this was a mechanism to allow the state's full faith and credit to guarantee voter-approved general obligation school bonds of local districts. And by doing so, it simply allows the AA rating of the state to be applied to the school district bonds. It's a program that's optional. School districts may opt to participate or they may opt out. By having a AA rating, it will substantially decrease their interest rates, especially important to small, non-rated school districts. The state has more than 190 school districts, and out of that many, there's only about 60 of them actually have a bond. So that means roughly two-thirds of the school districts in the state are small or seldom issuers of bonds. These people will be especially benefited by this particular program. We're appearing today to urge your approval of House Bill 3428 and the Dash 2 Amendment to do some technical corrections to the legislation that was passed to implement Measure 54 in the 1997 section. And especially we'd like to clarify the ability of the state to guarantee refunding bonds. The constitutional amendment noted that this was a particular feature of the program. However, we want to make sure that we have the exact statutory citations included in the implementing statute so that we can do what's called advanced refundings, which will allow school districts to once again lower their interest costs and lower taxes, because the bonds we're talking about here, the bonds that the state are guaranteeing of school districts, are tax-supported bonds. When they reduce their interest rates by increasing their bond rating to AA, they reduce the amount of taxes they collect to pay for these bonds. Today I have also, or sitting next to me, as Raleigh noted, is Cynthia Burns, the Attorney General. And Cynthia wrote the amendments to House Bill 3428 for us. And Mr. Chair, it's your pleasure, Cynthia, to go through to each one of these line by line, or however you would like to handle it.
Sure, there's not too many of them on us to discuss what the changes are.
the gist of the changes is to put in some definitions to make references and things a little bit clearer. When I started to work on the revenue bond or the refunding bond issue and look at the definitions, I started to see some inconsistencies and confusions in the bill. So basically what we did was put in a definition of school bonds, which is the bonds issued by the school district eligible for the guarantee, and a definition of state bonds. Then there are changes throughout the bill that are to be in accord with those definitional changes. We also took out some references to things that probably applied in Utah, the state that this legislation was taken from, but doesn't work in the state of Oregon. For instance, in Section 5, there's references to actions by a business administrator of a school district, and not every school district in Oregon has those. We also did some changes in Sections 6, 7, and 8 that are Section 6 describes the process of how the treasurer recovers funds after a school district is not paid and the treasurer has had to step in and pay. We clarified the amount the treasurer is entitled to recover from the school district, and that the treasurer in that instance would have the same rights as a holder of the bonds in terms of having an action against the school district for recovery of funds. We changed Section 7 a little bit to make it conform more with how the state always issues general obligation bonds, so that these would be, if the state ever had to issue general obligation bonds to pay a guarantee, those bonds would fall into an existing statutory framework for how general obligation bonds are issued. And the same thing is true with Section 8. Ultimately, as I'm sure you're aware, part of the ability of the state to get a good credit rating with a full faith and credit obligation is the constitutional provision that allows to levy a property tax in the event that the bonds were not paid, which has never happened, but it's there, and we changed the last section to just put these bonds into an existing framework for that mechanism.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Burns, I should have asked you to identify yourself.
I'm sorry, Cynthia Burns from the Attorney General's Office.
And would you also just, for the record, say whether the essence of anything in this bill or the amendments changes
no.
the material information that was given to the voters when they passed the
committee? There are no substantive changes in terms of the intent or really the workings of the bill. This is simply clarification and cleanup and trying to make it a little less complicated in terms of using existing statutory frameworks for bonds that are already there.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rasmussen.
I might have gone over this, but you could explain to me that I noticed that you're placing an emergency clause on this, and could you just speak to that real briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Rasmussen. We just flat overlooked the emergency clause, but if we have an emergency clause on it, it will allow school districts to participate in actively refund their bonds with a state guarantee earlier this year. Without an emergency clause, as you know, it'd probably be October before this was implemented. And with an emergency clause, it would be implemented when it's passed. It'll therefore, you know, we would estimate that several school districts would be able to do an advance refunding, save money in that process if they could take advantage of it now or when it's passed.
Thank you.
Is this going to change any of the conditions of the five districts that have already gotten bonds through this program?
No, Mr. Chair, it will not. It would just offer them additional opportunities, you know, if they had other bonds that weren't guaranteed by the state, but they could advance refund. This will clarify their ability and the state's ability to do advance refunding. Put an advantage, I guess.
Very good. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else here to speak about this bill, Hospital 3428? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Hospital 3428.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rasmussen.
Move adoption of the Dash 2 amendments in the House Bill 3428.
Representative Rasmussen moves adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3428. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
I move House Bill 3428 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Rasmussen moves House Bill 3428 as amended. The floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Kikori.
Aye.
Representative Mercury.
Excuse.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Shatterley.
Aye.
Representative Wells.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative Wills.
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen.
Aye.
Chair Strobel.
Aye. House Bill 3428 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Mr. Williams, would you like to carry the bill?
I'd be honored, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Close the work session, House Bill 3428. Since you're here, Steve, why don't we go to 2982 and open the work session on House Bill 2982. And you can give us an update on what the bill is, where we are, kind of, what issues remain.
House Bill 2982 dealt with the accepting value or new value in school districts and the tax on that value and whether that tax would be included in the school distribution formula as local revenue or not. So in the original hearing, the assessors came in and had some problems with how the bill approached coming up with exception value and having to identify individual properties and keep track of increases or decreases in exception value over the 10-year period that the number would be necessary for use in the school distribution formula. So after that, we tried to work on a slightly different approach. And you have before you now the Dash 4 amendment that we can go through.
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, what the Dash 4 amendments do in Section 2 is to say that the assessor shall determine the operating taxes on the exception value each year. And then it's not associated with individual properties. It's an exception, act on exception value for the school district that the assessor reports to the Department of Revenue. And then the Department of Revenue compiles that when the school districts are in more than one county, so they have to pay total for the school district, and then that number is reported to the Department of Education. And so then that number for that year then would be not considered local revenue in the school distribution formula for that year and the next 9 years. So once that number is determined for the year, it doesn't change in the preceding 9 years. So you don't have to worry about identifying individual properties then for that value for the next 9 years. There is also, the original bill didn't have any restrictions on the use of these funds. The amendment adds language that would require the tax on the exception value to be used for capital projects. Would have to be held in a separate account, and the school district would have to provide an annual accounting for the money deposited in the exception value account. And basically report on what capital projects were funded by that revenue. So that's the basic content of the amendment. There's been some problem with trying to come up with some numbers in terms of what the tax on the exception value would be. The data was assessor's offices first reported exception value to the Department of Revenue this year. And it looks like that the data that was reported doesn't exactly match what the intent of the bill is in terms of identifying the net increase in exception value. Mm. There's apparently some gross exception value where it's the value of the whole property and not the increase in the value due to the exception event, whether it's new construction or rezoning or what have you. So we're going to have to estimate what that exception value is by going back and probably taking the prior year value and assume that all of the property increases by 3% or slightly less than 3%. and then compare that number to the 98-99 value for that district and see that that difference is an approximation of your exception value. And then if we keep this estimation of exception value, then we'll either have to work with the assessors in getting the numbers to the net exception value, or take a different approach in something like tell the assessors that they have to increase the prior year by 3%, and then anything above that is exception value as defined in the bill. So that's a simpler process even than trying to deal with the problems that are inherent in trying to identify net exception value.
Okay, and then there was also an issue regarding urban renewal areas.
It's a question of for the exception value in an urban renewal area, whether that would be considered a part of the exception value that you would want to include in the total. The tax on that exception value goes to the urban renewal agency and not to the school district until the urban renewal authority releases that value to the role for regular tax like any other property, or it goes to the school district. And so you can handle that either way depending upon what you really want to get at, whether you're trying to get tax on the exception value, whether that tax goes to the school district or somewhere else.
Okay.
So that's a fine-tuning issue.
Okay, and then you briefly touched on the value, and we do have your revenue impact statement, but over... No, what were you going to say?
The initial revenue impact statement is too low. We have revised, now that we have more complete data on 98-99 from the Department of Revenue, we reviewed our estimates of property tax revenue and have increased it, and that will impact how much it is going to add to exception value beginning in the bill will take effect in 2021. So that number will go up, and I wanted to, before giving you a new aggregate number, I wanted to be able to go back and do the calculation using I'm assuming 3% growth in existing property and see what that added up to. But it's likely to be somewhere in the 27 million from that 16 for that first.
Mr. Chair?
Shuttering?
I assume that holds up then where we're looking at in 10 years, $200 million a year, then that's going to be
too low up.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that's too low.
With the assumption that it would increase as well, but you never know when you're looking at 10 years.
Okay, and just to clarify now, normally, under current law, without this bill, the increased value, the increment value, would be tax that would be considered local revenue property tax that would then be dollars that would not have to be backfilled by state contract, right?
Correct.
So
all of the rule tax on the existing value and any new property, new value, exception value, whatever you want to call it, the tax on that would be considered local revenue of the school district for operating purposes. And given the total statewide of property tax and state Brooklyn dollars, that portion, that increase would not have to be taxed on state dollars.
Okay. Let's talk about the 16-year-old loan.
So just to follow up, Steve, it sounds like school districts with a lot of new construction would get significantly more revenue under this proposal. Some that didn't have a lot of exception value, I guess, would get the same, right?
Well, this district that had a lot of exception value would have that would have that tax for capital projects available to them. What happens, the net result depends upon whether there's more money in the state school fund or not to compensate for what now isn't included in the formula of local revenue that isn't included in the formula that is now set aside for capital use. If there isn't any more state school fund dollars, then there's less money, state and school fund dollars, state school fund dollars for the formula to distribute. So from that standpoint, school districts would be getting less of that combined total from the formula, but to compensate for that, they would also have this capital project money, property tax. So you have to net the two out as to whether they're gain or lose from this process. And I haven't done that yet because of trying to work to get some good data at the district level.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but what we would be doing if this went forward just as it is today, we would be limiting the growth in local tax revenue that would go to operations, which would then not have to be offset by state funds. 3% a year, because the growth allowed in the major district. All other growth would be captured in to the local districts for capital project, all of it. And that's a lot of money.
Mm. Only those high growth districts.
It doesn't say high growth districts, it says any growth.
It would be distributed. But there are, in my 13 school districts, some that are
it has nothing to do with student growth, though. It has to do with growth in value. Say you had a new apartment building or a new shopping center, that would have a new value. That new value, the increment difference between the former tax and the new tax, would go to your local school district, even if it produced no additional students. At this point, it has nothing to do with the students.
Yes, sir.
President Federal?
Well, but the net effect, I guess, what concerns me about this is the net effect is still mixing of dollars. I know there may not be a per property direct impact on student growth, growth in student attendance at the district, certainly where you have substantial increase in the exception value in the district, it's likely going to be reflected in population increase in the district as well, and there's a correlation there.
Sure.
And just again looking at my district in comparison with Representative Williams, well, he may sound like a bandit, and I feel like the one I've been robbed.
She's heard of me. Well, and I do think actually there's some truth to what Representative Williams has said, because for years districts like his and mine have had enormous increases in attendance. And yes, there's virtually nothing at the state level that has allowed us to build buildings. So we've had to go back to our local voters over and over and over again and ask them for bonds to build buildings to house all these students that we're getting maybe a per student grant from the state for, but that still doesn't build any capacity. So we can have all the big budgets we want for distribution for operating money, but if you don't have any place to put kids, it's a real problem.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned about, and I don't know if this exists, but hypothetically an area that has a lot of student growth but not any growth in property values, because maybe it's an immigrant population or another, there's not a lot of project.
More turnover, for example, a neighborhood turning over. My neighborhood, for example, is 1950s housing stock, and now the housing isn't changing noticeably. You're just, the families are,
or kids
coming in because the old folks are moving out.
Well, yeah, I think there's probably all kinds of scenarios that you could construct, but I think in general, where you're going to have significant increases in student population, you're also going to have some increases in housing that goes along with that, which is then going to result in new value. If it's really, in double digits, you're not going to be able to cram all those people into the existing housing stock.
I appreciate what this does to assist in the capital expenditure on one side of the ledger. The problem is that it reduces funds for operations from other districts that are not benefiting on the capital side.
And that then puts the burden on the state, and it sounds like even more than was anticipated in the initial revenue impact, to backfill, if you will, those operational losses statewide. And I guess the other thing, too, I'm thinking if we anticipate a property tax local option, if you layer that on top of this, I expect that the local option is probably, you understand, a more likelihood of being adopted in high-growth districts. And so I'm wondering if you aggregate the impact of a local option plus the capture of this exception value tax, in some of those districts we're getting quite a disparity between some different districts around the state.
Mr. Chairman.
I would agree with you to some extent, although I think the local option still stands or falls on the basis of what a local community wants to do.
I'm just saying, my point is that my guess is looking at these, the ones that benefit, I'm guessing these are communities that would be more likely than most to support a local option.
Mr. Chairman, a couple observations. First of all, I don't see any relationship between the who would accept the local option and who's a fast-growing district, that where there's a requirement for greater facilities. I think the local option, if passed, is a decision that local communities are going to make based upon their belief that additional funding is necessary to support K-12 education in those districts. I very much like the direction this bill goes. I don't think it shouldn't be a secret to anybody that those districts that have high growth, first of all, they have tremendous costs in terms of just buying land on which to place the buildings. I met with the Beaverton School District recently, and they made the point that land has gotten so expensive, and they have to go out and purchase land to plan additional buildings in the next 5 to 10 years. And then you have the cost not just of the construction, but you have the cost of equipping the buildings. And districts like Beaverton and Tigard and Hillsboro and other fast-growing districts are spending significant amounts of their dollars that are coming out of equalization through the state just to equip these new buildings. And I think this is an example of where the current equalization formula really isn't fair to all districts. And this bill moves in a direction to correct that inequity, and I certainly support the direction this bill goes.
Thank you. Hey, are there any other comments? Representative Welch.
Well, I think within my district, and where some of my students go, is outside of my district, but some are really high growth districts for student population. And then farther to the west, along the coast, are going to be high growth as far as property values are concerned. But with a lengthy population and some of the disparities too, I'm concerned about, but I want to address because it's been one of those things that I think we've all been concerned about. School. My own community is going to be a high growth community and student population, and I'm concerned about what we're going to do for those facilities.
Right.
So I think if we can work out the details, I guess, on the equity issue and certain perceptions.
Right.
It's worth working on.
Well, I'd be happy to amend this bill just to make it just a straight systems development charge for schools. But, that might run into some objections. I appreciate the comments, and I really support the concept of this bill. As Representative Witt has said, I do think we have identified a couple of issues. So I want to bring this back and get some amendments going that will address those concerns about the total amount of dollars involved, the balance between capital and operations, the length of time, some better way to estimate what the need is and how much dollars is going to be pushed around by this kind of a formula. But I support the concept, and so we want to have this back in with some a little tighter focus.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? I just am noticing that when we got this printout, I think the last time we heard this was exception value, there were several counties that there was no data available for. Is that going to be forthcoming, or is there some reason why we can't get it for
We have data from more counties now, and that run that you have there, the original run, uses the wrong measure of uses the exception value as reported, which is too high. So well, hopefully that new one will be a better exception value. Net exception value would be
okay. Good. All right. If you have any thoughts about this the next couple of days, let me know or let Steve know, and we'll get some new amendments going on. All right. Thank you for everybody for your interest in this bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2982. Open the work session on House Bill 2289.
What's the number?
2299. Is there anything that's different about it from the last time we saw it?
Nothing, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Can you just remind us what it's about?
What House Bill 2299 does is it clarifies in the statute certain references to the tax court, i.e. it designates whether it's referred to the division or the magistrate division.
Did we ever resolve this issue about mailing or entry? That was a source of a little discussion.
No, Mr. Chair, no action was directed.
Okay. Anybody have any real concerns about this bill? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Are we in work session?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of House Bill 2299. Move House Bill 2299-204 to the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 2299 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I was shuffling my papers quickly trying to grab the right folder, and you did ask, I think, the question about related to what I had raised last time, and I didn't catch the answer to your question.
There was no change in the bill. We left it as entry on line 25.
Okay. I'd like to note that I think if we were to add on page 1, line 22, if we were to say subclause B, all written magistrate decisions shall be mailed to the parties, to the PO and to the Department of Revenue, quote, within 5 days of the date of entry of a written decision, it would allay my concern that we're creating a disconnect between the time period of 60 days and any requirement in the law about when people are notified who are parties to the issue. And that would address my concern. I'm not sure if anyone else shares that concern, but currently the timeline is tied to when people are notified, which seemed reasonable. We're undoing that, but I think there's a way to keep that connection and still address the issue that was a salient point, that the mailing date is uncertain and hard to track, and we can solve both without creating a different problem.
That's true.
Representative Rasmussen?
I'm willing to withdraw my motion in order to allow the conceptual amendment.
Well, I'm not. But is there any other discussion about that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Representative Shetterly?
No, in the work session, Captain Harris is there, he could answer.
Is he here? Okay.
Mr. Chair, my name is Scott Sedaris of the Oregon Tax Court. The Tax Court has no problem at all with the conceptual amendment. We have every confidence we'll get it mailed out well within the 5-day limit suggested by Representative Merkley.
Okay, so if we change the language to, say, in Representative Merkley, I think you said 5A.
Yes.
You're referring to 5A.
4B, line 21 and 22.
tacking on to the end of the clause on line 22 where it says Department of Revenue within 5 days of the date of entry of the written decision.
And then leave the entry change on line 25?
Leave everything, yes. Else.
Okay. Is that okay with you, Mr. Sedaris?
Very much so, Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Any address with me?
Does that need to be 5 working days?
Jane Merkel?
It doesn't matter to me, but I would leave it to the discretion of the department. Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, Representative Rasmussen, as a practical matter, it occurs the same day. We have no problem with 5 days.
Okay. Representative Merkley, if I understand your amendment, it would be to say, to add these words on line 22 after the Department of Revenue, delete the period and say within 5 days of the date of entry period. Is that correct?
Date of entry of the written decision period?
I'm asking Representative Merkley, what was your amendment?
Yes, I did it within 5 days of the date of entry of the written decision.
No, you were right.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen, do you want to amend your motion?
I withdraw my motion and move a conceptual amendment on line 22, deleting the period within 5 days and adding the words within 5 days of the date of entry of the written decision period.
Okay. Representative Rasmussen moves a conceptual amendment, line 22, after the word revenue, delete the period and add the words within 5 days of the date of entry of the written decision period. Is there any discussion on that? Any objection to that conceptual amendment? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2299-204 as amended with the 2-pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 2299 as amended conceptually to the floor with the 2-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Okay. House Bill 2299 moves to the floor with a 2-pass recommendation. Representative Merkley, prepare the bill, please.
I'd be happy to do so. Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2299. Open a work session on House Bill 2300. Mr. Waters.
House Bill 2300, we had heard last time as well. And what it does is it extends the period for appealing tax assessments in certain cases, and in those cases it allows appeal of a tax assessment to be filed within 3 years from the date that the tax is actually paid. So by paying your tax, you can extend the period to file an appeal and get a possible refund.
Okay. We heard this bill came down under 2299.
Correct.
Any comments about the bill from the committee?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shedley?
I'll move 2300 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Shedley moves House Bill 2300 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? The order? House Bill 2300 moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Representative Merkley, why don't you carry this one also?
Find it.
Representative Merkley is the carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 2300.
Chair, can I bring my pillow to the floor that day?
I don't think it's a lunch bill, though. I want to remind all members that if you look on your revised, corrected schedule, that day? What's that one? Let me just go over a little bit of some changes for next week's schedule. You see, on Monday, we're going to have work session only on the tax credit bill. So what I'd like you to do over the weekend is...
Representative Sarah and Williams, I think.
Yeah, they're not paying attention.
Okay.
Yeah, that's unbelievable.
Sure.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. We'll stay after 5.
I.
Oh.
Shetterly was the previous question.
Hi.
Okay, so Monday we're just going to go through the tax credit bills. I'd like you to think about those over the weekend. What I want to do is to go through those line or credit by credit, and we'll be very democratic, and we'll just see what the majority of the committee wants to do on each one of those credits. And then when we...
More democratic, isn't
it? You like that?
Yeah, small d.
And then when we get through with those, we will create new amendments that incorporate the wishes of all members of the committee. Okay? So, take a little time, see what you'd like to keep, what you... Actually, I think there'll be three choices. Keep the credit as it is, delete the credit entirely, or amend it in some way, either with the sense that there's another sort of type of system. Not posted for today. So we'll begin at precisely at 8:30 on Monday. Now, the other thing that I'm asking staff to do, you'll note that we're going to start meeting at 8:15 because we do have quite a bit of work to do. We're going to have transportation, local option, you know, a few other little bills to do. And so we'll start meeting at 8:15 on Tuesday, and we will be providing coffee that day. So be sure to be here on time for that day. Then on Wednesday, you'll note, it's usual cafe today.
He knows how to get us here.
Then on Wednesday, Representative Rasmussen and I have a long scheduled appearance in Portland, and so we won't be able to be down here until later, but that is also going to work out okay because that's the day that Representative Merkley and the housing folks will present their bill. So we'll meet at 9:30 on Wednesday, and that will be just on housing issues. Representative Lori is now chatting.
No, I'm talking about something that's pertinent to the agenda.
Okay, did you have a comment?
No, I just asked if the hearing the low-income housing group had met.
I think they were meeting over at the local establishment, you know, offline. And then, 8:15 the rest of the time. So, depending on how good you are, we'll decide on a daily basis whether we get coffee or not.
Excuse me?
Promptness counts. All right. Have a good weekend. Committee's adjourned.
All right. 3:45, 4, and then I got to leave at 4:15, 4:30.
Okay.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No.
3:30.
No problem.
No,
that's
my
thing.
We're going to the top. Yeah, no, I haven't.
Monday's fine.
Yeah, they're old. Monday's on what?
Oh, yeah, that could be true.
Maybe they need to be repaired.
Only lunch, but it looks like.
Yeah.
I've got to go find an opera in Corvallis after.
Are you? Yeah.
Lunch with your lovely wife and I said